Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
What if there was a way to feel younger for longer? Well, there is. Your body needs something called the NAD plus molecule to help you age well. When you're young, your body makes a lot of NAD plus, and that helps you make energy, it helps you keep your DNA healthy, absorb nutrients well, and it protects your cells from stress. But once you hit about 30, your NAD plus levels start to drop. The good news is that longevity scientists have found some things that can help, like niacin, niacinamide, and Niagen. They help your body make more NAD plus even as you age. All three of these are in an amazing formula called Qualia NAD plus. Check out Qualia NAD plus risk-free for up to 100 days at neurohacker.com/Dave15 to save an extra 15%. That's neurohacker.com/Dave15, Qualia NAD plus. It's what I use. What if there was a way to level up your energy, get rid of stress, and take more control of your body? Welcome to Quantum Upgrade. This is a new technology that taps into quantum energy to help you feel amazing. Quantum Upgrade has a lot of different products that help protect you from EMF and help activate your body's natural healing abilities. You can expect better sleep, more resilience, less stress, and better blood flow. The cool thing about Quantum Upgrade is that the products are backed by a lot of heavy-duty scientific studies, and there's a new measurable upgrade. You can now use Quantum Upgrade to increase your consciousness levels between 1400 and 2200 on the Hawkins map of consciousness. If you don't know what that means, do some research because it's impressive, it's fun to learn about, and it's something that I've come to understand. Ready to try Quantum Upgrade? Visit quantumupgrade.io/Dave for a 7-day free trial.
Hey everyone, it's Dave Asprey with Bulletproof Radio. Today's cool fact of the day is that if you needed another reason to care about your gut flora, we just figured out that the more gut flora you have, the better you respond to cancer treatments like chemotherapy and immunotherapy. We think that it's because the inflammatory response to those gut flora actually helps your body fight cancer.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Today's guest is a repeat guest, and it's Grace Liu. Grace publishes a blog called Animal Farm under the name Dr. BG. She's got a bachelor in nutritional science and food science. And she was on the podcast earlier, but we had some audio quality because she was joining from China. So we've got a really good, clean video and audio signal today. And we're going to talk even more about the gut microbiome, about resistant starch, and what you can do. One of the interesting things about Grace is that she lost 50 pounds of fat by doing things that are related to the paleo diet, but including more resistant starch and more of the gut bacteria stuff. So, Grace, welcome to the show, or welcome back, I should say.
Thank you very much for having me again.
Let's...
Yeah, I'm so glad our video and audio are all working now. I felt so bad when it was like subpar to what your normal quality is.
Well, sometimes it happens. I have guests from around the world on the show, and I do my very best to get it. But the important thing is that we get the information out there that's useful for people who are looking to perform better and feel better, and hopefully maybe gain a little bit of a better understanding about just what's going on in their guts and their brains, et cetera, et cetera. So you're most known for your writing about resistant starch. So most of us know like what starch is. Can you just walk through what is resistant starch? What are the types of it? Where do you find it? And why should we really care?
Yeah, it actually started about a year ago. I had heard about it actually a couple years ago, and when I started doing my own research and seeing it online, then it really hit home, because I have a bachelor's in food science, but I didn't learn anything about it. It had just started to be discovered around the 90s, and that's when I got my degree. So there's four types of resistant starch. First one is RS1, and it's kind of found in the seed coat of little plant babies, essentially. Seeds and nuts and legumes and whole grains and maize. And when it's embedded in there, and when we chew on it, then they're resistant. They're carbs and polysaccharides, but we can't break them down. And what happens is they end up in our gut and our flora eat it. RS2, on the other hand, are starches that we can cook. But when they're raw, they're known as RS2, and we don't break them down at all. They have no calorie worth, and they don't provide energy for us whatsoever. But they provide about 1 or 2 calories per gram when they go to our gut flora, and they transform these, and they make them into saturated fats for us, actually. And one of them is butyrate, which we all love, and our ghee and our butter and bulletproof hot coffee, of course. And then the third kind is known as RS3. When we cook the starch, and once it cools down, there's crystals that actually form. Some of these crystals actually can be used in lithium batteries because they conduct so well. I know there's a crystallinity, which the hydrogen bonds, my biophysics is terrible, but you know, there's this exchange of the energy can flow, apparently, from this crystal form. So when we heat food up, like let's say we roast a tuber, or we have whole grains like rice or white rice or barley or beans, when we heat them, outside of the granule, then the carbs come out. The strands of amylose and amylopectin, they're actually double helix, so they're really strong, energetic structures. They come out, and then when they go into solution, they're digestible for us when they're warm. However, when it cools, upon cooling, the water molecules leave the helical double-stranded form, and they leave out through the center kind of the core, and then they tighten. And as they tighten, our amylase enzymes can no longer break them down. Our pancreas and our saliva, we have different amylase enzymes that break down carbs for us to provide us energy, because the end product is glucose, and we can use these as energy. However, we can't. They become resistant, and only our gut flora can break them down, in our small intestines and our colon. So that's RS3. And then RS4 is actually a chemical form. It's almost like a pharmaceutical, kind of like different creams and other forms that are halogenated that stay around in our system forever. Some of the carbohydrates, they can be chemically modified with different groups added on, like phosphates, and they last a little longer in our body. But I don't really recommend them because we don't really know what the downstream effects are and how they affect receptors. Yet they do are eaten up by gut flora and provide a lot of saturated fatty acids and energy.
So if someone's new to this idea of starch, we all know starch, you know, starch is potatoes, starch is rice. Starch is bread, things like that. These are different, though, because these are stuff that your body cannot actually digest, but things that the gut bacteria can digest, right?
That's absolutely right.
Okay. And there's four different kinds of these things, and you've been doing a bunch of research about what the body does with these. Can you tell me how the body just processes normal starch? So people who are listening could sort of get an idea of how would I handle normal starch? And then let's just play that through, say, with like resistant starch one and see what would happen when the body tried to digest it.
Okay, let's take the simplest one. How about table sugar?
All right.
Looking at sugar, palm sugar. Palm sugar it's a little lower GI. It's a little more fructose, actually. But table sugar is kind of one-on-one glucose and fructose, a disaccharide. And when we consume it, our body has disaccharidases and breaks it down. Then we get the individual molecules of fructose and glucose, and then we absorb it. It has a very high GI, almost a GI of
So you got to explain what a GI is, because everyone listening doesn't have a degree in nutritional science. Remember that.
GI is not the most optimal test, but it's a good metric.
What is GI? This is gastrointestinal, right?
Glycemic index.
I know it's glycemic index, but people listening have to understand your things, or they won't understand what we're talking about here. So GI is the amount that something you eat is going to influence your sugar. Glycemic index.
Yes, exactly. And because it depends on the person consuming it, it's actually very individual. You know, you can have a very super healthy person and the GI will be low for a certain food, let's say, because their blood, okay, so it measures how much your blood sugar rises over a certain period of time, and certain foods will impact this differently. So foods that release the sugar faster will rise the sugar GI the highest. So the table sugar is usually the standard, about 100. And then actually white potatoes, russet potatoes can go even higher than that based on the standard. white potatoes, russet potatoes, when they're consumed, the GI can be over 100, like 105, 108. So it can really impact the blood sugar. The higher the blood sugar goes up, the higher the GI can be. So a lower glycemic food would be a food that would have more fiber in it or would have less impact on the blood sugar because it's combined with other things that we eat.
So like butter is a low glycemic food because it doesn't move the amount of blood sugar you have at all. And sugar would be 100 on the glycemic index, right?
Exactly, right.
Okay. So no
mashed potatoes, even really kind of the junky mashed potatoes, but we add butter or cream, let's say the fat content in the cream, has a GI of zero. And actually, because they buffer how fast the sugar goes into our bloodstream, they lower the GI of the food originally. So it changes from what it was originally. So let's say we take a resistant starch food. I kind of like lentils, you know. So it has a GI, depending on what you read and what chart you read. It could be between 30 or 40. And lentils may have, you know, more RS1 because it's in the seed coat. And then it has, for every 100-gram serving, maybe about 4 grams of 4 grams of resistant starch 3 when you cook it and cool it out to room temperature. And then there's other fibers in there. We call them non-starch polysaccharides, but NSP, or just this is our conventional fiber. When you read a package label, that's the fiber that we see, and it's regular conventional fiber. Right now, it doesn't seem that the food companies are really putting in the RS content. For most foods, it's very little. You know, maybe for potato chips, it's like 1 or 2 grams, and lentils is much higher, but they're not really currently being reported.
I mean, so resistant starch can be useful as a prebiotic to feed gut bacteria, but you just said potato chips, right? And lentils, which are like full of carbs, most of which are not resistant starch. So you're going to be getting a relatively high carb diet, and lentils have a bunch of anti-nutrients in them, and some of those fibers are irritating to the gut. Like, why would you eat a food that had 4% resistant starch when you could just get pure resistant starch and add a tablespoon to your food?
Oh, that's a really good question. Well, lentils, it's kind of debatable maybe what the anti-nutrients are. I mean, I think if we soak them, you know, a little bit and then cook them, you know.
You can certainly reduce lentils. Like between beans and lentils, more people tolerate lentils than beans. I have them on the suspect foods list because I find that most people who eliminate lentils and beans and grains at the same time really like the quality of their day. And when they add lentils back in, they can tolerate it, but they aren't quite as good as they were the other way.
I see. And it does have FODMAPs. So yep. For people with IBS and a broken microvilli, where our disaccharidases, where the enzymes are that break down FODMAPs, they are broken and somewhat compromised. So FODMAPs can, from foods like whole grains and regular starches, they can be a problem. Even RS2 is a problem for some of these people as well.
So if you've never heard the term FODMAP,
so yes,
what would that be?
Okay, so these are the foods that may cause a lot of gas and bloating for people because they don't break down. They actually are resistant, but not in the traditional sense, usually because normal GI tract should be able to break down these type of foods. And so what it stands for is fructose, so like table sugars. Some food can be irritating if they have a lot of sugar in it. High fructose corn syrup, of course. So fructose, oligosaccharides, disaccharides, which are two sugars combined. Mono, I can't remember the M right now. And then different sugar alcohols like that come in fake sugars, like maltol. If you want to buy a sugar-free chocolate, you know, these cause a lot of gas for people because they're not broken down for.
From sorbitol and maltitol, right?
Yes, yeah. And, you know, other people can digest it. And so it's actually bearable. Sometimes it's a good test to see if, you know, we have some dysbiosis and problems in our gut.
So
lentils, you know, I defend them a little bit because in terms of colon cancer research, it almost comes up on top. If it feeds our flora in a good way, because we don't have as much dysbiosis, let's say, because it has all four kinds of fiber, you know, oligosaccharides, the NSP traditional conventional fibers, and then the resistant starch 3, over and over, they you know, seem to show that the colon health is almost optimal and ideal for longevity. But it is a problem, you know, if people have dysbiosis. And that's the key for me, you know, and why I developed the 7 steps so that people can get over this hump really quickly if possible, you know.
So what percentage of people don't have dysbiosis in the U.S. today?
You know, the rate of diabetes is like 1 in 10 if you combine kids and adults. You know, we look at different conditions, which are all on the rise for the last few years. They seem to just be going up on the rise. One out of 10 children in the U.S. May be diagnosed as celiac. In the U.K., it's even higher, 1 to 2%. Too. And autism has gone up hugely. It's almost 1 in 50 in some geographical areas. And each one of these is characterized by digestive issues. And then we have our, you know, IBD, IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, and inflammatory bowel syndrome.
So I tend to find that it's such a common thing where whether you have dysbiosis, which means you have bad gut flora, or good gut flora, is not even a real question, because you have hundreds and thousands of different types of bacteria in your gut. And whether you're officially over the line or not, I would say very few people have optimal gut flora, because we've changed the biome of the planet. So the soil, which is the source of our gut flora, has broken stuff in it, and we get that in our guts, and it comes from our food and what we breathe and eat and touch. Right. So there is definitely debate about lentils, and they're the most tolerated one, but I found so many people who believe they tolerate lentils, quit them for a week, and then add them back in and go, oh God, that's that feeling I used to have. So they're like a food that you should pay attention to, as maybe it's good, but maybe it has problems. But the question about, okay, why would I eat a food that had a tiny amount of resistant starch in it if I didn't want the other, for instance, the other carbs in the food? If you had to choose between eating sushi, which is also a good source of resistant starch, versus eating lentils, well, you might choose the rice, or you might just take a spoonful of resistant starch, which is something that I've experimented with for about 9 months, using resistant starch on a regular basis. So I guess we can move on from just the lentil question, but what happens when you eat resistant starch?
So I want to make one thing clear. The RS2 is actually not equivalent to RS3. And early on in my journey, I was thinking that they were very similar, because there are a few studies that differentiated them. But now there are a few more. When I had my gut improvements, it was always with RS3. So I had steamed tubers and white mountain yams, and that helped recover my gut really immensely, along with some soil probiotics, like the soil that you're talking about.
Okay, so people who are driving in their car right now in traffic and listening to this, I'm really stuck here, because I'm not sure that I know what RS3 versus RS2 is. What happens when I eat any resistant starch?
Okay, so let's go back to the mouth then. So when we eat any kind, whether it's raw RS2, so RS2 is all raw and not cooked. It actually behaves the same way in the mouth as cooked RS3, but cooked RS3, as you mentioned, has carbs. Why would we choose it? But has carbs in it. So for people who are really carb sensitive, like someone who is diabetic and has to be careful about counting carbs, they would get the carbs with it, and that may affect the blood sugar, like we were talking about the glycemic index. So when they're in the mouth, either one of them, our salivary amylases and the other enzymes, we try to break it down, but nothing happens. And then it goes to our stomach and then to the small intestines. So two things can happen. If someone has dysbiosis in the small intestines, these can start fermenting. Even RS2, and this is, you know, seen in people. These are people who may have reactions with RST because it acts like a FODMAP. I've seen and observed complaints of headaches, or, you know, body aches and dysbiosis and bloating. Anything that happens with Metamucil or fiber can also happen with raw RST, whether it's potato starch, like that's a common use online, or the maize. I think you're using the high amylose maize, ham. Mm-hmm. So these foods, if someone has different kinds, it depends on the dysbiosis going on. It could be a Bacteroides overgrowth, and for some people it's Klebsiella. So Klebsiella is often implicated in different autoimmune conditions like ankylosing spondylitis, Hashimoto's. I used to have Hashimoto's, so I kind of pay attention to the different organisms, you know, that are implicated. So if someone has these growing in either their joints or their body or their, you know, different organs where these organisms have translocated, when people eat a FODMAP or a triggering food, whether it's mycotoxins or, you know, fungi or RS2, it could trigger these effects. It's not a lot of people, but that can occur. Now, RS3, if it's a cooked one, same thing can happen as well in the ileum. You know, we can get this fermentation going on. But let's say someone's healthy, then everything just moves along. And then in the colon, these ferment and just provide a lot of energy for us. The end products are butyrate, which is very similar to butter, and it feeds the colon cells. And we get vitamins produced, even CLA, which is an anti-fat steroid hormone, conjugated linoleic acid, which helps burn fat and improve our lean muscle mass. These are produced by, you know, different bacteria that all are good gut flora, both in the small intestines and in the colon. But when I looked a little more closely in this journey the last few months, RS2 and RS3, they actually feed different flora.
Okay, so we eat a resistant starch. Our saliva doesn't know how to touch it. It goes into the stomach. The stomach doesn't touch it. It goes into the small intestine. What happens to resistant starch in the small intestine?
So if it's a healthy small intestine, nothing.
Okay, and then it goes to the large intestine, and that's where the good stuff starts to happen.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's
right.
It's like a winery. There's some fermentation and, some really good different lactic acid and the butyrates that give that buttery taste. So all these things happen in the colon. It's like the big fermentation in the composter.
Okay. And in the rest of people, and I'm curious what percentage that is, but in the small intestine, this hits the small intestine, and what happens there?
Okay, so RS2 can feed mainly three groups. Now a lot of Ubiome and Genova testing and AMGUT, American Gut, I'm sure you've heard of these are direct testing of the gut. If you have Bacteroides growing in the small intestines, these can provide some problems. Like, so people with IBS or GERD and heartburn, sometimes there's Prevotella or Klebsiella or other, flora that gets stuck. There's a reversal. A lot of gram negatives end up, they're supposed to be in our colon, and then they flip, and then they end up in the front, the foregut, which is higher up, which is the small intestines and even our stomach and esophageal area. So some people can trigger GERD and small intestinal fermentation. And that's why these people may avoid starches and even RS2.
Okay. So how would I know if I was avoiding RS2? Because remember, people listening to this have no idea where to find RS2 or RS3 or RS4. This is the first time they've ever heard of these. So I'm trying to apply this for, someone who's listening to this going, okay, how do I apply this to me? So how would I know if I was eating RS2 again?
So RS2 comes in raw starches and okay. IVs.
This is the potato starch thing, right?
This is the potato
okay.
starch, right.
Got it.
And a small amount of it in my bionic fiber.
Okay.
Yeah. So one benefit of it is in trying to restore and improve the gut, it can help to generate more fermentation if it can all get to the end. So it's very important that people take a solid starch with it, an insoluble starch. So either eating, fruits and vegetables, even better if they can eat something that has even more fiber. I kind of prefer, lentils and whole grains if people can
eat. So you're actually eating whole grains again?
I haven't since I've been in China. Yeah, I've
wow.
been in rice. It's full of cadmium and arsenic, so we don't do a lot of it.
Yeah, I wash my rice really carefully. I eat some rice. But other than that, I don't do other grains. Are you doing other grains as well? Because whole grains for most people is whole wheat, quinoa, spelt, all that kind of stuff. Are you doing those as part of feeding the bacteria in your gut?
Not very often, no. But
okay.
Improving the gut, with eating the soil probiotics and getting, enough balance. I eat it occasionally. I don't have bloating or other problems that I used to have. So that was a really good score, when I got my gut better about a year ago.
Got it. Okay. And so let's talk about some of these other studies that are out there around kidney health and resistant starch. Have you come across anything there?
There are a couple animal studies, but we also have to be careful with animal studies because sometimes they don't translate. But yeah, the kidney studies, they look quite, some of the RS2 studies, they look very, very impressive. But there are a couple, for instance, Bodenham recently in 2014, he gave a very high dose RS2, the high amylose maize starch, and for 12 weeks to diabetic patients. And he saw some improvement in the insulin resistance. Their A1C was actually pretty good going into the study. It was like something like 6.4% or 6.4%. That was pretty good. But there's no body fat loss. There's actually a higher triglyceride level in the fasting. Sometimes the studies, unfortunately, don't translate. But yes, the animal studies do look really good.
So when I did potato starch, I got the problems from potato lectins. Like I started getting a rash and some sore joint stuff. And I quit doing potato starch a week or two after. But I handled the resistant cornstarch reasonably well. Like I could do 2 tablespoons of that at night. I don't get gas. I don't get bloating. I take it with probiotics. But I don't feel and I can't measure any difference between doing that and eating some cooled and reheated rice.
I see.
With probiotics. So I kind of feel like there's this huge party going on about resistant starch. And for some people, it really is transformative. But it seems like if you're taking the right probiotics, and you take those with some form of resistant starch, one of those three whatever kind of one tastes good to you. And you do that at least some of the time, like you're kind of covering your bases. And this is like another kind of prebiotic, like inulin or fructooligosaccharide. You know, how important is resistant starch compared to all these other prebiotics and compared to just like eating some food that has some starch in it, that some of which will be resistant?
That is such a loaded question, Dave.
I'm a little bit skeptical here.
I love your experimentation, because I know in the beginning, I know a lot of your listeners and readers couldn't unfortunately hear it all, but we hacked your gut, remember? And I had the same problem as you. I had three things. I had a yeast overgrowth, a bacterial overgrowth, and a parasite. And like you, once I saved my gut and fixed it all, then I could eat anything I wanted. And I didn't see much difference with the chia starch at all. Like you. Yeah. I didn't notice any, you had the rashes and different problems.
From potato starch,
once,
right.
Yeah. Then once you healed everything, you were able to take a little bit, I recall. But then you do better with the corn. But you don't see huge improvements. I took chia starch, I didn't see huge improvements either. I was already kind of semi as ripped as I'm going to get. Okay. You know, and I didn't see huge athletic performance changes, but what I go down more with now, because we have access to different testing and like your testing, with BioHealth or, Doctor's Data. And now Genova has all these wonderful tests. We can drill down the commensal bacteria. Now, what I have had on and off is the high amount of Prevotella. It's common in some autism and spectrum based off Hashimoto's. Mm-hmm. Prevotella bacteroides is actually supposed to be really good. You know, I always thought it was a great sign, because Burkina Faso, kids that live in rural Africa, they have high amounts of it because they eat whole grain millet and a lot of whole grain foods and a lot of soil probiotics. And I always thought it was a great sign. But recently, you know, I had a lot of immense stress. I think I lost some bifidobacteria, which is kind of like the ultimate gut guard, in my opinion. And I bring it up because RS3, the cooked rice, like you're eating, actually feeds bifido. The good ones, the Bifida longum, which is one of our ancestral strains. There's so much research on Bifida longum, and I can go into a little more detail later. But on the Genova testing, they're starting to look at that because it's so important as part of our gut flora. It has to be there, or there's so many problems that can erupt. But with the stress, I think I lost all my Bifida longum, and I was kind of supplementing, but you know, we moved, and then I wasn't supplementing as well. And I don't really talk about Bifida longum that much because I just presume everyone takes it. It's such a baseline, you know. And then, you know, I took enough soil probiotics and it boosts Bifida. But when I had the stress, I had, you know, the immense stress, and it brought it all down. I actually developed heartburn when I tried potato starch again. Yeah, wow. I just didn't take it because before I had immunosuppression with it, so I just stopped. I just gave it up until I fixed my gut totally. But then, and I took it on and off and didn't notice anything, so I just kind of stopped it. But I discovered that Prevotella was my problem. And this can be for a lot of people, and they may not realize actually what's going on. Potato starch feeds a group of fiber. It's a fiber for a group of characters in our gut, but it's really different. RS3 is more like inulin. It's more like other plant fibers. And our body has probably harbored gut flora that have co-evolved to eat starches, because we've only been cooking for almost 1.8 million years. And potatoes always kind of creep me out in a way, to eat a raw one, you know?
Yeah, eating raw potato doesn't seem very natural for some reason.
Have you noticed that no livestock get potatoes?
Yep. Well, they don't actually get raw kale either, come to think of it.
Yeah, no.
I wonder why that is.
Isn't it? Well, kale's not expensive, maybe, but potatoes are cheap.
No, if you try and feed kale to a horse, the horse won't eat it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's because of the oxalic acid.
Yeah. Potatoes have a lot of trypsin inhibitors. So the best way we want to get sarcopenic would be to eat a raw potato over time. They always cause protein malnourishment. And in livestock, it will eventually cause, you know, pancreatic adenoma, hypertrophy, cancer.
Interesting. So maybe raw potato starch isn't such a good thing either? Or is potato starch safe because it doesn't have all the other stuff in it?
You know, because starch is isolated off, you know, I don't think it has a problem unless you have a huge problem with sulfites. Initially I thought that was my problem, but you know, I can drink a bottle of wine. So I couldn't figure out what it was. And then other people, I talked to them, and not enough people do testing, so I didn't know it was actually the bacteroides. So raw starches like tapioca or the raw rice, like horchata, maize, and potato starch, what they feed is a really distinct group in our gut. They're almost, I consider, kind of like bottom feeders, you know. They feed animal bifido strains, not really the human ones. We have very few human ones that eat raw starch. They feed bacteroides, And Bacteroides, as you know, a lot of paleo people have huge amounts of it because they're omnivorous. They eat everything. They've been around for millennia. We've co-evolved with them for so long that they've co-evolved with us, and they eat everything. Privatella eats everything. So that's the problem. You know, if someone has GERD, you know, you kind of have to cut back on all starches to really heal. And this is why AIP, strict paleo, primal, all these kind of lower carb diets, I think, are very healing for people with these conditions. But when we talk about cooked starches, you know, when I looked at the studies actually for RS3, I was shocked. Cooked starches feed everything. RS3 alone, there are some forms of it. I'm not even going to talk about their names, but there are like cooked cool versions of corn, and they've ground them up and then they make them into a supplement, but they're not really available for the general public right now. RS3 can feed all our ancestral human strains, all the good bifida, the bifida longum, that are really immunoprotective. Bifida longum can even break down gliadin in
Petri dish. So if you wanted to simplify all of this and you wanted to say, all right, I'm eating foods that I like that make me perform well, but I'd like to make sure I have an optimal number and type of gut bacteria, you could just take a scoop of RS3, type 3 resistant starch. You can mix it with water, drink it with probiotics, and you would achieve that goal.
I mean, hypothetically thinking, I mean, yeah, I'm a former pharmacist, you know, retired.
Right.
I am functional medicine practitioner. I love potions and supplements. I mean, if I tried it out and I felt it was safe, I would definitely, you know, test it out thoroughly and then see and look at the studies.
And can you buy RS3 to do that with today?
I haven't seen it commercially on the market yet.
Okay, got it. So that would be useful, wouldn't it? Or at least I guess we'd want to test that a little bit more. But
too, that it acts, they're so tiny, the granules, they may not be carried all the way to the end of the colon.
Okay.
That's the problem initially too I had with potato starch. Some people would even complain of like cecum pain. I'm like, how do you know you have cecum pain? But you know, sometimes I think some people's correlations can be correct because animal studies, they burn out the cecum. They can have problems. And they do hypertrophy. It's not a bad thing to hypertrophy, but if it gets too big. Yeah. So carrying out these fibers to the end is only possible if someone takes an insoluble fiber with it. So something like Metamucil. That's why in my bionic fiber, I include the Metamucil because it will carry fermentation all the way to the end. And plus it feeds all the bacteria that we need. All the bacteria kind of co-feed each other because it's such a community. It's like Facebook.
So it's a community, but let's just say that your community has gang members, which at this point is more likely than not, right? So you dump a bunch of resistant starch and other things to, quote, feed the community, but you're feeding everyone there. And the idea there is that somehow we're going to hopefully feed the good guys and the bad guys are not going to be there. But it seems like many people who try sugar or starch or resistant starch, they're feeding a fungus in the gut, they're feeding yeast, they're feeding whatever bacteria and even whatever parasites are present.
Yeah.
Right? So I find that when I keep my overall starch consumption reasonably low, I keep my sugar consumption even lower. And some days I really don't have any starch. And when I do have starch, I only have it in the evening. That like my energy levels, everything works really, really well. If I eat starch 3 times a day and take probiotics like I was doing when I experimented with more resistant starch, I would eventually start to gain weight and my energy would fluctuate. So it seems like there's a timing component. There's a it's complex. We barely know what's going on in there. Do you think it's advisable for people to just sort of go out there, buy resistant starch and start eating a lot of it without like doing a test of their gut or without taking probiotics? Or should they just be eating buckets of sauerkraut? Like it seems like there's a lot of stuff we don't know about this, but we're all taking steps to do something about fermentation.
Yeah, we so all want a better gut. I know everyone wants you know everyone's striving for that because now it's actually possible. You know, we know all the studies, you know, it's starting to translate into human studies. We also hear all the stories, right? Some of the stories, I don't know which ones to believe sometimes because we don't hear all the factors. Like what did they, you know, what else did they do?
Yeah.
But I hear your hesitation. And now that this journey has been, you know, I've had a full year to contemplate, you know, I really believe in the testing because we don't know what we're feeding. I thought I was great all along. This time I didn't get immunosuppression with potato starch, but then weeks into it, bam, like out of nowhere, I got this heartburn and nothing else changed. You know, I was on an 80-20 diet. I'm kind of lowish carb. I eat like 200 grams of carbs a day, but it's like kind of higher fiber, you know, for me, and I do like 5-10 mile runs occasionally. And
so you're on a moderate carb down a low carb diet.
Yeah, right? I can't go too low, and I can't even take like some of the really wonderful kind of supplements like black cumin, which is so good for AMPK and telomeres, but it lowers my blood sugars too low, so I have to be careful. And even if I eat too much high fiber, like my version B of bionic fiber, it lowers my blood sugars too much. All the inulin and green banana flour gets my gut so good that I, you know, I can get low sugar too. So testing is really ideal because to know what we're feeding, we have to kind of understand if there's any vipers or gang members like you talked about. And we can see some of it. Unfortunately, the testing won't give us the yeast. We have to do more of a medical functional medicine test to do that with BioHealth Doctors Data, Genova testing, or Great Plains. Then we really can see, you know, what is going on in there. And we can also see different things with digestion. Just not getting enough acid will produce a lot more yeast and Clostridia and bad bacteria up in the gut.
I've been recommending for more than a decade that people take betaine HCL, especially as you age. I've been taking betaine HCL with every meal, I think, since 1996. And I used to have really terrible heartburn back then, and I don't, and I haven't in so long. But I just about don't remember what it's like, except that one time when I took too much betaine HCL, which causes heartburn. So not enough.
That's a great way to know your dosing, though, because it can fluctuate. You know, when we have more stress, we might need a little more to boost digestion because Bifido goes down. Bifido makes the lactobacillus, I mean, they're wonderful. They make the lactic acid that keeps the upper gut kind of more acidic.
Although they don't do that in the stomach itself where the stomach acid is, right?
No, but they work in conjunction because it's such a community, and other things can flourish that, like H. pylori, you know, as soon as you know someone has H. pylori, you know they don't have acid because it's gone aggressive because it's trying to keep everything acidic for itself.
So about 2 years ago, I did have some H. pylori and I got rid of it with mastic gum and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
And I think we talked when you were on the podcast last time, I had, what was it, a single-celled parasite that comes from like eating, and probably in Asia, we're guessing is where I got it, because I've been traveling a lot the last couple of years. And I ended up taking a prescription anti-parasitic for it, which helped quite a bit and solved that problem.
And then I remember you got your six-pack back.
Yeah, exactly. And
that was a great story.
It was really weird too, because people are looking, you want to feel good, and all of a sudden there's something dragging you down. And then for years there's been, oh my God, maybe it's parasites, right? And a good number of people do have parasites, and then a good number of people maybe don't have any problems with parasites. And there's a group of people who say maybe they're even good for you if they're the right kind of parasite. They're just another kind of probiotic. So I think we can generally say some species of parasites are definitely harmful. Others we think are harmful, and some others, I don't think we really know that much because we just thought they were harmful. We never studied it. But that one definitely was slowing me down and making me not have the weight loss results I expected. But man, if you're at home right now, you're going, okay, I have an extra 15 pounds. I could try cutting carbs. I could try the Bulletproof diet. I could go vegan. I could eat a lot of potato starch. I could take probiotics. I only have $300 to spend on lab testing, which is actually a large amount of money. You know, do I poop in a tray and send that off to get it looked at to know what's growing there? Or do I get my blood test and see what my inflammation is? It's getting to be a huge amount of testing. How do you think about prioritizing all of these different things you could try or things you could test?
Well, I look at someone and see what their health goals are. So number one, what is their health goal? How aggressive they want to get? Two, what conditions they're trying to improve? Is it brain gut? Is it just brain? Is it gut?
Well, I think most people want to be full of energy and they want to look good naked, right?
Oh yeah, that's just like me. Great. So
there you go.
Or yeah, you might want to look at neurotransmitters and the gut for sure. So there's two tests, you know, urine and stool testing. The stool test is almost useless without the urine testing because you want to know what's spilling over.
So you test the urine for neurotransmitters?
No, the neurotransmitters, I haven't done it recently. So I forgot, you know.
The saliva. You like the saliva one?
There's different ways and there's different testing available. Neuroscience is one company that does it.
Okay. So you like the neurosciences saliva panel for neurotransmitters, and you like a urine organic acid test, and you like
for sure. Right.
Okay. And then you like the poop test to look at what bacteria and other fungi and potentially parasites are living in the gut.
Potential parasites. Yeah, and if possible, a three-day collection, because then you can really see if the parasite is really there. It's hard to catch, actually. Yeah.
So hard to catch would be a literal term. It's not that fun if you've ever done collect your poop and your poop for 3 days and your urine for 24 hours. I can proudly say that the last time I did a 24-hour urine collection, I was actually traveling in New York. And in my backpack, I had a little jug of pee. It was very exciting, let me just tell you.
All around New York.
Exactly. I'm
like, yeah, one hand full of coffee and then your jug.
Like, don't drink out of the wrong bottle. No, it's kind of funny, but that's what happens when you're going to do a test like that. And because I live in Canada and I wanted to work with a U.S. company, I didn't want to be shipping pee over the border. So.
Oh, yeah. It's been really from China, too. They don't have a lot of the
pee. Yeah.
Testing. I mean, and then you can also get into hormones. There's a really simple precision analysis is the one I like right now. They do a really good urine test where you just pee on a stick and you get so much information, all the cortisol and the turnover of cortisol. Sometimes you don't see the turnover of cortisol and you get these low normal numbers, but actually it's turning over too quickly for some people.
Cool.
So for body fat reduction, I mean, the version B I found to be super helpful. I actually have to stop it sometimes because it gets my sugars down too low, but inulin is one prebiotic because it feeds all our ancestral core strains. And then we can, you know, when you're doing these testing, it's really awesome because you can see on the urine organic acids changes. You know, the inulin is one of the few prebiotics that can give us changes kind of rapidly if someone doesn't have like a lot of intolerance for it. You know, sometimes intolerance is really high, but urine organics will see inflammation go down, the pathogen loads, you know, that the secretion for the dysbiosis markers go down. Even some of the yeast markers can go down faster.
So taking a prebiotic like inulin can help. And my whole takeaway from having spent a good 9 months really experimenting with different resistant starches and digging on it is that resistant starches are an important form of prebiotic and that different people need different amounts of them depending on what's going on in their gut and what they want to be going on in their gut and all the other stuff they eat. But it's kind of like, you know, you're balancing, you know, 45 things all at the same time. And I think there's a lot more science to be done there. And it's all very multifactorial. So it's cool to come up with protocols like the stuff that you've been working on that says, you know, try this to get these results and try this to get these results. Are you familiar with the research about collagen and butyric acid formation in the gut?
No, I didn't know there was a relationship.
It turns out that...
I learned so much from you, Dave. I love it.
Oh, likewise. Thank you, Grace. I put this in the Bulletproof Diet book. By the way, I have to wave this around because this just came. I just got it like yesterday. This is a picture of the Bulletproof Diet book. If you're listening, sorry you missed out. I'm holding it in front of my face right now. But it turns out that right after resistant starch, within about, I think it was about 90% as efficient at forming butyric acid, is collagen. In the gut.
You eat collagen,
and it's basically animal starch.
Yeah, it's animal, right? It's animal prebiotic.
Right. So when you do that, the bacteria in your gut can also form butyric acid from that. And then I found another set of studies that showed there was a marked difference between consuming butyric acid, i.e. eating butter, in the upper part of the gut versus forming it in the lower part of the gut. So my takeaway from this is that you got to eat something that the bacteria in your gut can eat. Because when I went through my, I want to be like an Eskimo phase and gave myself food allergies by eating essentially one serving of broccoli a day and nothing else one serving of broccoli a day and no other vegetables and no other carbs and lots of meat and tons of fat, I really didn't, like that actually damaged my immune system. It was not a good idea. I couldn't make enough mucus to line my gut. My gut bacteria got off and that was just a bad experiment. Don't try that at home. So, that said, I know some people seem to thrive on very, very low carbs. I'm just not one of them. But what you can learn from all this is that you can choose sort of different templates for what you're going to do. And Grace, what I like about your work is that you've done the paleo thing. You've lost 50 pounds. You're getting a lot of lab data. And you're one of the people who's at the cutting edge of figuring out these are the universe of things or the galaxy of things you could do that are going to have this type of influence on the gut. But the edges of that are very mushy. And a lot of biohacking is like that. Like, we kind of know, even the Bulletproof diet, like this is a spectrum. Like, this is the top. I can't tell you for sure that sockeye salmon is better than king salmon, because there might be differences in EPA and DHA ratios when talks. Right. But, like, we know they're both better than tofu. Like, we can all agree on that. Right. So I believe that the resistant starch guidelines that you're working on can get us in the right, at least the right quadrant of where we want to be. But that for person A and person B, the results could be pretty different, and you have to honor those results.
Yeah. So glad that we have the testing, because it's because of recent testing and the, you know, people that I've seen over the last couple months and my own experiences and talking to people. Sometimes you can't hear these experiences until you talk one-on-one, like on email and talk to people. You know, characterizing our gut, we're getting so much better at it. So I talk about inulin because inulin feeds something called acromantia. And you're going to hear a lot more about it in the next few years because it basically burns fat.
Nice.
Deplete it over time. So two main species elderly deplete over time. And this is probably what affects their telomeres, I believe. But bifidobacteria and acromantia, completely depleted in elderly as they get older. The centenarians have lots of bifidolongum. Bifidolongum is our ancestral strain, which I talked about at my AHS talk this year. And inulin is what feeds it. And a couple other things, you know, but they,
Inulin only feeds it if it's there. So you have to supplement it or hope it's there if you're going to take inulin, right?
It's part of the paleo, you know, diet. Onions, leeks, garlic, if people can tolerate. So if these are FODMAPs, though. So if the gut is not to the point where it's restored, you know, the tips of our villi have the enzymes to break down these foods. And so when they're not there, then they just ferment and things grow. Or there's not enough acid or not enough bile. Like when I got the GERD incident, immediately I took betaine, I was fine. And then I also added a couple other things, you know, to bulk up digestion. I started walking with every meal and added in ox bile. Ox bile is actually really critical.
Yes.
Vitella. Yeah. And a lot of people, you know, the gallbladder gets all congested, or, you know, you're not digesting protein, then the whole pancreatic tree gets kind of congested. So we need to add, you know, some enzymes if necessary, besides the pepsin and, you know, it's to get the juices that get the chemotrypsin and the trypsin, you know, going. So when the upper gut gets broken, acromantia can't grow in the lower gut. And we really need that, because acromantia is really the key for longevity, I'm thinking. Bifidobacteria and the acromantia.
So when am I going to be able to just buy, like, a can or a bottle or a capsule of all of these various strains? And I say this as a guy who takes handfuls of pills. I have no problem with this stuff. I take four or five different strains of probiotics, or not strains, four or five different capsules. Like, I started taking in 2007 the probiotic 3 from Advanced Ortho Molecular Research. And then I quit it after like 3 years. And then you reminded me, oh, you should keep taking that. I'm like, all right, yeah, that's a good idea. Like the research is awesome on that. I just kind of fell off that wagon.
You have too many other things.
Yeah. And the soil, the probiotic things since about 97, I've been on soil-based organisms.
Yeah. You are so ahead of the curve, Dave. You have no idea how ahead of the curve.
But weighing 300 pounds and having your brain turn off will make you really pay attention to these things. But okay, so I've been doing those things, and I just added Align GI, which is from a major company, and it's actually a really good probiotic with great research. I don't know if you've come across it.
What's the name of it? Align GI?
Align, like A-L-I-G-N. I'm forgetting the species right now, but
that's a bifido, but I'm not sure. Is it just one strain in there?
I think it might be one of the infantilis strains.
Yes.
I noticed that there was actually good studies on inflammation, and I'm always trying to work on inflammation because I grew up with an inflamed body, so I tend to get inflammation more than the average person. Thus, I know a lot about inflammation. So I've noticed the difference from that one. And then I take the Primal Defense Ultra, as well as Prescript Assist. Like, that's kind of my handful of probiotics. But I also sometimes take a liquid this, and sometimes I take a dairy-based that. And I'm an extreme example, and I read everything, and I still don't exactly know what to take. And I poop in things, and I test all this stuff. So what is someone who's listened to this podcast, like, what's their takeaway? I'm going to do one thing, maybe two things. What would they be?
One thing, just know what's in your gut. I mean, yeah, there's so many great testing. Find a good practitioner or, you know, and I think the Genova test illuminates a lot, because it's actually the one test that goes down to the species level to give us bifidolongum and acromantia right now.
So you want people to get the Genova poop test.
Yeah,
got it.
2200, yeah. And if you,
Sorry, say the name of the test again.
The 2200.
The 2200. And how much does that normally cost?
If they have a non-HMO insurance, it's only $99. But from Canada, I don't know what the
But so normally, $99.
$443 right now. If it's paid cash, without insurance,
So $99 isn't a lot of money for a lab test, to be honest. That's pretty cool. And you cannot order that online. You have to go through a doctor now, right?
I believe so, but there may be some outlets online.
Yeah. Okay. So if I can find one, I'll put that either in the comments or in the show notes, because it would be really, really nice for people to do that. And I always thought it was more, I always go through one of my various doctor friends, but I could see like doing that once a month for a year just to see like what all would happen. It's a lot of collecting of poop though, which is sort of not so much fun, but.
Well, when you get a really great restored gut, I found that the poop actually doesn't smell. It will be like a compost dream when you get to that point, and then you'll know. Yeah. Because I know when I have 80-20 on my diet, on the weekends, you know, we'll have, you know, my sister's a wonderful baker, so we have goodies occasionally. And then it's like, oh, it changes very immediately. And that's what we know about the gut microbiome now. You know, it can change within hours. And
I can tell you with the Bulletproof diet, my poop doesn't smell very much at all. Okay. I don't get BO, and even like morning breath. Like all of those went away after a while, and they've just stayed gone. But if I go out and I eat, you know, a bunch of sugar and some sort of, you know, bad fat that I didn't know was in some restaurant food, like I'm not going to like the next morning. I'm going to smell bad. I'm going to have bad breath, and you know, my poop is going to smell again. But yeah, you're right. A healthy, if you have like, you know, if you have to burn candles every day in the bathroom, like you probably don't need a $99 poop test to know that there's something bad going on in your gut.
But then you can tailor it. So it's like, you know, it's just like a good mechanic. You can do the diagnostics and then start.
Yeah.
That's just, we have these steps now. And then, it can go a lot faster. For me, it took years to figure out what was going on. I even worked with some of the experts in the field. And it was still, you know, a little slow, a little struggle.
And I believe you know Donna Gates as well, right?
Oh, yes. I just met her. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, cool.
She's just a beautiful angel for the gut.
Yeah, Donna Gates is like one of the original people who paid attention to this, even long before I did. And I'm not by any means a gut researcher the way she is, but like 25 years ago, she was working on this. Yeah, and that's just amazing. So I was amazed to get a chance to meet the woman who basically started what's become the GAPS diet was Donna Gates, and that's amazing.
I mean, when I got the GERD, I mean, I was really shocked. I mean, I had Bristol 4s, you know. I was eating fermented foods and I still got ill. So, you know, you don't know what you're feeding sometimes, especially based on your, you know, previous history. The second thing I would do, if people can tolerate inulin's my favorite prebiotic. I wouldn't even call potato starch a prebiotic because it actually doesn't feed our human strains except for Bacteroides, one of the bottom feeders, which we need, you know, but it doesn't feed Acromantia. It doesn't feed Roseburia, which is very, very important for peanut allergies, gluten and dairy allergies. It doesn't feed Bifidobacterium. It feeds animal Bifidostrains. So in my opinion, inulin is far superior, and our paleo ancestors probably were eating more onions and garlic and these things raw and safely for millennia. And we still do. Every culture still embraces these.
Now this is an interesting question here. So I actually recommend that people, unless they're using it medicinally, that they don't eat garlic, because there's a whole body of research on what garlic does to alpha waves in your brain. You know, the stereotypical Italian housewife, agitated, hard to be calm, hard to be focused. You can replicate that. Eat 6 cloves of raw garlic when you don't eat any garlic and watch what it does to your brain. You can see it on brainwaves. You look at Jainism. You look at various like Hindu things. You look at some Chinese medical texts. There's a whole body of research about how it's ungrounding and stimulating in a way that isn't positive. So I love garlic, but I don't eat garlic on a regular basis. I do it occasionally. When I do, I develop body odor. But when I do, I also can feel a difference in my meditation for 3 days. Like my brain isn't as calm and focused as it should be. And I can see it on neurofeedback. So it's interesting that those onion has the same chemical as garlic, but much less of it. So I'll use like spring onions, which have so little that it doesn't really matter.
Okay.
And so it's interesting with those foods. Are there other ways to go about getting, basically feeding those probiotics without using medicinal herbs, which is what I would classify those as? I'm not opposed to garlic and onions, but they have effects that we aren't accounting for.
Have you heard of sunchokes?
Yeah, I used to grow them, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, they're kind of like parsnips, but they're actually really, really rich in inulin and other oligosaccharides. Apparently, rutabagas have a lot of oligosaccharides also, and that's why I kind of like beans and lentils. And I know they can be offensive for people with corvettes, but they have oligosaccharides. I actually did research as an undergrad on the raffinose oligosaccharides.
And Oh, cool.
So gram for gram, inulin, as well as RS3, they feed our gut, and they produce way more butyrate, actually, than gram for gram for RS2. I'm not sure why that is. I've seen this observed in it just a few studies, not very many. But inulin might be a little more ancestral. And other foods that are rich in it are
chicory.
Chicory, yeah. And the roots of the top part is actually Belgian endive.
So when you
disrupt the plant, they get stressed. So it's actually a stress response, what inulin is and what the oligosaccharides do. They protect the plant and serve as a buffer against cold or mechanical stress and heat stresses, different stressors. So they would actually enrich chicory roots, by disrupting them a little bit.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's funny what stress does to plants, and we sort of assume all the plants are the same. And even something like coffee, like if there's insect stress or any kind of infestation of the plants, they'll make more caffeine in response. It's a protective thing. So, well, let's see here. We're coming up on the end of the show. I'm just looking at how long we've been chatting. And last time I got a chance to ask you the top three recommendations you have for people wanting to perform better based on just all the things you've learned. And the I'd like to ask you the question again when we have good recording. So what your top three recommendations for people?
So it might have changed a little bit. I'm even more into the gut. Now we see such a great connection, and I just would love for just people to talk more about different things that are coming out in the news. Every day there's more and more novel ideas coming out. And we don't know everything. I mean, everything's always shifting. So I'm the first to tell people, okay, I was wrong, or, I'm learning new things as we go along. Be more bulletproof. I mean, I think you have such great ideas, Dave, and you've so many people and products are just so awesome. I love the glutathione that you have. It's one of the best on the market. It helped my sister and our family for overall health and removing heavy metals. And so just really grateful for your products. Third, maybe just get more Zen. I think I brought that up last time and I still struggle with it. So
yeah, it's all that garlic, I got to tell you.
Yeah, too much garlic.
I'm just kidding. So basically, so some form of calmness and using stuff that makes you perform better or feel better, and just paying attention to your gut. Yeah, it's great advice, Grace. Thanks for coming on, and I really think that you've been doing a service in helping to just talk about this strange interaction between all these different forms of starch, which we're really just paying attention to. We at least know different forms of fat now and different forms of protein. So different forms of starch obviously would matter. And then looking at all those complex interactions between combinations of those in your gut and what comes out. So I think this is probably less of an advanced nutritional space than protein metabolism or fat metabolism, but it's up and coming. So keep doing the experiments you're doing and keep writing about it, because it's adding real value for people. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much for having me on.
You've probably heard me talking about whole body vibration on one podcast or another, but if you haven't, check out the Bulletproof whole body vibration platform called the Bulletproof Vibe on upgradedself.com.
Did you know that Cyber Monday didn't even exist before 2005? And now it's the ultimate online shopping day of the year, even bigger than Black Friday? It's true. In fact, last year's Cyber Monday was the biggest online shopping and savings day ever. And now this December 1st, I'm upgrading Cyber Monday to help you hack your holiday shopping list by kicking off a special online event with exclusive savings. The savings continue on December 2nd, when, in celebration of the Bulletproof Diet book launch, we're kicking off a 12 days of Bulletproof. That means you'll get great 24-hour savings on a different product in the Bulletproof online store every single day from December 2nd through December 13th. And in the spirit of giving, you can even save 25% more on top of the daily discounts and cross up to 12 names off your gift list all at once by getting the entire bundle of products with just one click of your mouse. If you haven't already, just make sure you sign up for email updates at bulletproof.com or like Bulletproof on Facebook to make sure you get all the details. Then just mark your calendar to watch your email inbox and the Facebook page starting December 2nd for your invitations to each of the 12 days of Bulletproof. Thanks for listening, and I'm excited to help you give the gift of Bulletproof this holiday season.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.